Welcome back to Music and Mezcal. I'm Brandon Back, and I'm sitting here with the one and only Jim Black. How are you, Jim?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Can I pour you a mezcal?
Please do.
So, Jim, you're recently back in Vancouver. So when I started working at Guilt & Company, which is where we met, which is, you know, live music venue in Gastown, you played there all the time.
Frequently.
You were one of the big staples that played there. You played your solo stuff. You played with Ground Up. You played with Star Captains, which we'll get into hopefully soon in lots. And then you, like 3 or 4 years ago, you moved up north.
Correct.
Cheers.
Cheers to that. Cheers to coming back.
And then you most recently played at Guilt & Company again, like a couple weekends ago, with Star Captains.
Yes.
Which was neat because it was, so I think I'd seen Star Captains since you left and you went up north to the proverbial Lake Wobegon or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I think I saw Star Captains play once without you.
Correct.
Which was, you know, it was like, whoa, this isn't Star Captains. And then the gig that you guys just recently played, you did it without Max, because obviously Max and Ray have a little one now, so it's a little bit harder for them to juggle. So I haven't seen Star Captains, the original lineup, probably as long as you guys played. How long has it been?
Since we had the full lineup or since we've been playing?
Since you've had the full lineup. Well, both.
Yeah, so I guess while I was gone, I think they did a wonderful job performing in my absence. Yeah. And Star Captains is like this extended family where there's so many honorary members that are fully capable of representing the shared values and beliefs of the band. And some of those guitar players filling in for myself include Micah Granovich. Scotty, of course.
I was looking at a Star Captains photo today that had Scotty in it.
There it is. And who else? A number of other people. And of course, we have two guitar players in the band, Gavin Young Ash, who often would play bass. One of the delightful things happening, speaking of like original lineups, that now that I'm back, is Gavin is hopping on guitar, so we have two guitars again, which I think in my absence would often, he'd be playing bass. He's so skilled, he can hop on any of those instruments and do really well. So the full lineup, it's been such a long time and such a luxury to have all those folks and so many members. I mean, when it's a full band, it's a lot of people. So
yeah,
I think, and now, with Max and Ray having their wonderful child, just celebrated birthday, little Zay, shout out.
Four?
Third birthday, I believe.
Third birthday, That's
correct. And Max stayed home and we had a young up-and-coming musician, Justin Wan. Mm-hmm. And you've probably seen him around Guilt & Company a bit now. Interesting connection there. When I was studying to become a public school teacher, I was doing my practicum in Surrey at Guildford Park. He was in 12th grade and I was teaching him.
Oh, neat.
And this is like not long ago. This is like 2019. And I identified his prowess and prodigious skills and techniques at that time. And he's gone through, post-secondary education and some of the institutions that we went to. And he's come into to be a wonderful player himself. So he was filling in for Max. So again, it's just this like, it's this family thing. And it's kind of, even the space studios that we have in East Vancouver, it's kind of all this one big thing and involves a lot of different people. And it's kind of, I don't even know if I answered your question there. But
I don't remember what the question was. Obviously not that important.
When was the last time the original group played? I don't know. Maybe we can guess when it would happen again, or where. I'm sure it'll be a Guilt & Company when it does happen.
I liked what you did talking about Justin.
Justin Wan, right?
You meeting him as a student, the teacher student in that relationship. And it reminds me of when I was in theater school.
Okay.
And I think this can be similar across many different realms of the arts. But I remember one of the something that one of my instructors said to me, like maybe my second or third year there, and she said, "We're training our peers. We're training you to get to, like, we're not going to be your teachers forever. Is we're all, you know, you, in the, specifically in theater, right? You look at a play, and it's people, you know, the cast, the characters range from the ages of life, right? So as a neat way for them to someone to describe it, that you're training your next level of cohort, right?
And I think that's true in the mediums that we're speaking of, and in arts. I've noticed in post-secondary, those programs, like the music programs, are so much more, you know, tightly knit than other programs. Like, because you may perhaps know that you're going to work with these people moving forward. And there's something I was thinking about before the interview today, like thinking about the band and thinking about music and their influences. And I think that we, like as Star Captains, I think we've learned the most from each other, you know, like we learn from our peers, like just thinking how much influence we've had. And I think we all reflect on it sometimes, and the way, like, you know, the harmonic choices we make and aesthetic choices, I think are largely affected by our peers, you know, and especially Star Captains. It's like we all kind of have this shared language that kind of comes from, and I mean, a place like Guilt and Company is a great example of this. There's like, you know, this collective kind of, you know, identity in the.
Like a strong music community growing up? Was that something that was always a big part of your life?
I'd attribute that to my success coming from growing up in South Surrey, White Rock. Mm-hmm. There was a wonderful music program, still is a wonderful music program at one of the high schools there. And the teacher there, David Prosnick, his son, Tim Prosnick.
Cool. Small world.
One of our closest mates. I mean, I went through school with Tim, and we're best buds. Shout out to me, Boom Bap. Of course, his sisters are accomplished, wonderful musicians. But the dad, Dave Prosnick, and another person, Kevin Lee, had this band program there that for like 30 years they just built it up. And so many great musicians from the whole Lower Mainland came out of that community. I kind of joined the program late, just kind of being like a rock guitar player, and just got in and couldn't read music or anything at the time. And being part of that and the community around it. And then even like thinking back, like in the 90s, back in the 90s, back in my day. On White Rock, there was like, you know, there was opportunities for bands to play. People were renting out halls and having shows, and there's great bands and like tons of rock bands. And I think we'd join these bands and we'd all have all these concerts and stuff. And oh man, like there's so many things I could jump around to. Actually, I just moved back from the north, which I definitely want to share some stories about, because that's been the most impactful part of my life recently. But moving back to White Rock, in the spirit, thinking about this community that kind of shaped myself and a lot of wonderful musicians we know. We've actually, myself, my partner, several of our friends have started a nonprofit art society.
Cool.
To host concerts at some of these like halls and venues that were there when I was young, that supported our interests. And, you know,
I remember going to those places when I was a teenager. That was like where the only place you could see live music if you weren't, you know, legal drinking age or didn't have a really good fake ID or when, you know, didn't all those things, being a teenager, being really into music, it was a lot harder, but those were the places that you could go to. And those were, and I saw some really neat shows at some of those venues.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, I mean, you folks provide a venue where like music happens. And when you do that, if you're like curating events or whatever it is, it's like realizing that people have to provide a place for this to happen. Yeah. And it takes a lot of work to facilitate that and all the logistics around that. So, I'm so grateful for that community I came from. There was like so many people wonderful at guitar. I could list like Mike Granovitz, Tristan Paxton, Gavin Youngash, like all these wonderful guitar players from White Rock.
I had no idea you guys were all from like the same hood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it, super grateful for that. And I mean, I feel like, I could list off a bunch of people that contributed to developing our musical.
Did you continue to study music after high school, like academically?
Yeah, after high school, I took a couple years off and played in like some rock bands and like this awesome rock band. It was called Super Jaded, and we played like it was like in the early 2000s. If you remember the new metal and this kind of these sounds were in vogue.
Yeah.
And we did some tours with Tim Prosnick, and we were in this band, and toured down to LA and back, and then I thought, okay, maybe that's not for me. And I ended up going to college in Nelson, BC at Selkirk College. Mm-hmm. They have a wonderful contemporary music program there.
Cool.
And that was definitely life changing. I went there and with another fabulous musician and from White Rock, and I ran into him and he was like, I'm going to the school. And it was kind of like a 2-in-2 program with Berklee College of Music. So you could do 2 years there and then maybe the last 2 years at Berklee. And that was something I was interested in at the time. And so I went to Nelson, BC, like not really knowing what I was getting into. And
this was like early 2000s, you said?
2003.
And you were like 21?
Totally. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And, I remember being so such a broke young student and I didn't have a,
in Nelson,
which is a great place to do that. So, and it was a totally different, academic experience from what I had in like secondary school, which was really interested in music then, but not many other things. And, ended up just being so just totally enamored by studying music in post-secondary, and just got like graduated with honors and was like a hall monitor and was there just all day, like every day, like working on stuff. And
did you have a specific field that you were studying?
I was a performance major at that school, and there was a lot of great options there. Like it's such a wonderful place. It's like a contemporary music and technology program. So everyone had to learn like how to use Pro Tools and MIDI, like early Pro Tools, actually, now that I think about that time. And that's something that stayed with me and has helped like in all my composition with the Star Captains and always having like skills on those tools, like not great skills, but enough to capture ideas with the whole crew. And it's kind of been part of my role in the band, but did that in performance there, but was really introduced to like playing jazz in like a small ensemble scenario. And that really helped my playing a lot. I learned to read music better, learn theory better. And then came right back from there and went to Capilano College in North Vancouver.
When were you there?
2005 to about 2007 or 2008. I never finished there. I started kind of going part-time, but that's where we met all the members of the Star Captains. So we all met.
Yeah, that's what I was asking when you were there. Yeah.
So Max was there. Gavin was there. A bass player named Nimish Parekh was the original member of Star Captains was there. And the same drummer I mentioned I went up to Nelson with. His name is Mike Arda. Shout out. Brilliant musician and recording engineer. Later on went on to great things and taught at some amazing schools, and it's a wonderful producer himself. But so we were all there and we started, and at the same so this is a good story. So I was working at a restaurant in White Rock, and this is how this is the genesis of Star Captains. So here's the story. So I'll take a sip before this one.
Cheers.
So being the poor college student I was at the time, came back and
you had just you had just left Nelson.
Yeah, so flashback to the year in between my 2 years in Nelson. I came back for the summer and needed some work. So I had a friend who was a chef at the restaurant, and I went to this restaurant. I was like, hey, I need some work. So I was working in this kitchen at the Washington Avenue Grill in White Rock. Shout out! I'm just gonna keep shouting out people that and I care about.
That's good. Just keep shouting it out.
I've been waiting for this moment. But they had tons of music there, and they're like, hey, you're a musician, you're a music school, and like you should play. I'm like, when I come back from college, I'm gonna play here. Go to college, finish my second year, and when we come back, we take a weekly gig on Thursday nights, and it was martini night. The martinis were so cheap, and we were the house band, and it was the Jim Black Trio at the Washington Avenue Grill every Thursday for martini nights, and we were playing, and Nimish was the bass player, and he was also in the band Five Alarm Funk.
Yeah.
So yeah. Shout out to Five Alarm Funk. And so those two bands, you know, all those bands coming up at the same time, right? Like Boom Booms and Five Alarm and us and Hey Ocean. That was the music scene at the time. But anyways, maybe we'll get there. But so we start off as a trio, and I remember the day. He's like, man, you got to meet my friend Max. You got to meet Max. He's the best. And I wasn't going to Capilano yet. He's like, oh, man, he's going to be awesome. He's going to play. I was like, oh, okay, who's your friend, Max, from music school? You know, I guess he can come play. And I remember, like, you know, when you remember meeting, some people you're like, don't really remember how you met, but I remember the first time I talked to Max. You know, this is in 2005. And
this is Zapersky, obviously, right?
Max Zapersky, for context.
Shout out.
Called them and I was like, hey, you should come, you know, come play. Maybe just come for the last set, you know, like I'm not sure you're going to play the whole night. And he comes like star of the night with his keyboard. And I just remember him walking across the restaurant with his keyboard. And I was like, oh, okay, he's here. And I plug in his piano and we play this like kind of Herbie Hancock intro from like live Miles Davis recording, you know, like C minor is like, oh, like we still this day, like half the Star Captain songs are in C minor. And it's kind of a joke. And it's like the chords from that intro, like basically like, you know, Max writes so much of the music and that stuff's just in our DNA, you know? So there's the Jim Black Trio featuring Max Zapersky. And then Gavin started to come because Gavin was kind of part of the crew. And then it was like, then it turned to the Jim Black Collective because it couldn't be like featuring, you know? And, eventually from those restaurant gigs, we were just like, hey, we better just give this thing a name and start writing songs instead of just playing all these kind of cover songs and like jazz kind of standard tunes and funk songs and stuff like this, whatever was part of the repertoire back then, probably some of the stuff we still play to this day and some things that you might even, you know, some kind of like, musical output that you might be, what you recognize from what you hear at a place like Guilt & Co, you know,
right,
jazz and funk and a lot of improvising and a lot of good beats and stuff. So, that I just remember, you know, and that's like something with music, right? It's like life, you know, it's like you work, you know, work in some restaurant and it's here and you get a gig and then people join and you name your band and it's like, it's just all this big long journey, you know?
Yeah. Do you know about the Star Captain's tag in the bathroom? Do you know that story?
I learned about this from the episode.
From the episode we did with Max? Yeah.
We were all surprised.
I love that like none of you guys even like, I don't know. We still have no idea who did that. And it's still there.
So for context, for someone that might not have seen the other episode, at Guilt & Company in the second stall there in the back, there is a very nice piece of graffiti, street art, if you will, of some of our lyrics with a kind of like a graphic kind of design around it. And we always thought that you folks were just repping the band as
it. No, it just showed up. It showed up one day. And the weirdest part was that it showed up. I don't know if I mentioned this in the other episode, but it showed up like right after I remember having a conversation, my boss and I having a conversation about keeping on top of graffiti in the bathroom.
Totally.
Because the minute you stop, you know, he's a big proponent of the broken window ideology, right? The minute you let one thing go, people go into a place like that and they're like, oh, I can treat this place like shit because they don't care.
Totally.
So if you see like, and there's one guy that I actually think he used to be staff and I won't shame him on air because I can't prove it, but someone used to always write Slayer rules on top of that, like the wood frame of one of the doors.
I almost wore a Slayer t-shirt today.
Well, like there's no shame in Slayer, but like whatever, but I don't know, Slayer rules and black Sharpie in the bathroom. And then there, and then it was soon to be followed would be like a dick with balls and a dick with no balls and all sorts all of variations and all the themes. But it, so that, and then the next, like, and I had just painted all the stalls and I that happened like 2 days after that.
Oh my goodness.
And I went in there and being like, my first reaction was seeing someone had drawn all over the wall was like anger. And then I paused and I remember talking to Trevor, Trevor Twos. And we're like, should we just leave it? It looks good. And it's been there for years. It's been like 4 or 5 years since it's been there.
You know, at one time there was a cocktail named after one of our songs on
Lightwork.
Yeah, album title. And I don't know if I ever had the chance to say, but it always gave me such great pride that was like so wonderful to have our art represented in that form. So thank you for that officially.
So we'll have to shout out our bartender who created that drink. That's Kevin Tron.
The best.
It's one of those ones that always might come back, but it's a clarified milk gin is what it takes to make it.
Right.
So you can't, there's a lot of work that goes into it. Oh, okay. There was lots of love that went into it from Kevin.
Well, then that's fitting. So I would describe our music. So I didn't finish my post-secondary.
Oh, sorry.
No, I get off on tangents. I went to Selkirk College, Capilano College, never finished, took 8 years off. This is like an inspirational story for folks that might need to hear this. Took almost a decade off and then went back and finished my degree at Vancouver Community College.
Oh, cool.
BCC.
Yeah.
Shout out.
I've taken a couple one-off like screenwriting classes from BCC.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful, yeah. They have an excellent music program that is kind of, it's like new music, a lot of musicology. My major of performance kind of morphed into like musicology, ethnomusicology. It's kind of a field of study there, studying non-Western musics and amazing professors there, Giorgio Magnanensi, he's like director of the Vancouver New Music Society, master conductor, and wonderful artist, David Gordon Duke, all the jazz musicians' favorite classical music teacher, just a wonderful person. And yeah, finished my degree there and even had to do a few classes at Douglas College and then clawed my way through, got a degree, and then with a lot of support from my partner, thanks to her, kind of convinced me to go back and then supported me through that journey. And then somewhere in that story, I realized I was supposed to be an educator, a teacher. So I went and completed my Bachelor of Education.
When did you do the Bachelor of Education?
In 2018, I went to Newfoundland and Labrador and did that at Memorial University of Newfoundland.
So that was before you moved up north?
Yeah, it was before I moved up north. So it's been so nice to
come. So where's that story? Where's that fit in? The Vancouver, Labrador, Newfoundland to, and where up north were you? You were in Yellowknife?
I was like 1,000 kilometers north of Yellowknife in the Arctic Circle.
You were in bumblefuck nowhere.
Exactly.
That's the technical term. I don't know if you know that.
That's the technical term.
Did it have a name or was it just like Nome, Alaska and then this place?
I was in the top of the Northwest Territories in a place called Fort McPherson is the colonial name, but the indigenous name of the from the Gwich'in people, Dene people, is Tête Léger. So that is the closest thing that people might know is a few hundred kilometers from Inuvik, which was a large center at one point, is no longer, but 400 kilometers from Tuktoyaktuk and the Arctic Ocean on the Dempster Highway. So
right up there.
I was, way up there. And you know, there's lots of it's equally in the middle of nowhere, but there's also so much life and culture and wonderful stuff. Yeah, I can't wait to tell you all about it. How I got there, went to Newfoundland and Labrador. My wife's a Newfoundlander.
Right.
Amanda Duke, shout out. She's not my wife. She's actually my common law partner, 14 years, but
yeah.
I say wife.
No, no judgment.
Girlfriend sounds like, you know, at this point, like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, girlfriend sounds like, you know, the, what you have on the side, right?
Yeah. Full-time person, Amanda Duke from Newfoundland and Labrador. And, Memorial University of Newfoundland is the most affordable, university in the country, unless you're like from Quebec and you study there. But, my education degree was extremely affordable. And yeah, it was kind of like I started making decisions, like really how it happened. I started making decisions in life, like based on like the path of least resistance. Like if doors were opening one direction, closing another, I was like, let's go. So finished my degree and I was like, okay, maybe I'll think about going to UBC or something. And just saw like challenges and, some issues with going there and mostly cost. And, I remember I cold called, Memorial. This is what I started doing. It's like cold calling, places. And, that's how I ended up in the North, but I'll get there, I guess. I called and got the head of the department and it was this wonderful woman, Dr. Andrea Rose, a shout out. And, I was like, yeah, I would tell you about the program. Sounded amazing. And I was like, how much is it? And she told me the number, like including books. And I was like, okay, well, I put in my application, got accepted. And it was kind of like my wife was applying to all these master's programs all over the country. Mm-hmm. And she's a social worker. And I had no intention of going to Newfoundland really, but I put in this application and got accepted. And for context, this is right after we finished Lightwork, which is our big achievement as a band. And it was this time when I was like, I'm going to Newfoundland. And it was like, it was hard to, you know, to bring that up and mention that to the group. And of course, like us all being like family and best friends, everyone's so supportive. And so I started this journey in 2000, I don't know, like 16, 17. Yeah, it's probably about right, 15. Went to Newfoundland and Labrador for 2 years, got my ed degree, came back and did my practicum in Surrey, where I met young Justin Wan. And finished my practicum in December of 2019. And so in the start of 2020, I was ready to be a music teacher. And then we all know what happened a month later.
No, what happened in 2020?
So my wife had been hired at University of Victoria in a job in like, I always get her job wrong, so I won't butcher it here on the air. She works in she supervises practicums for students in like early childhood education and social work and stuff like this at university. So, we moved to Vancouver Island and I did some work, managing like a trades company, like some skills I have and from the side and, did that for a while. And then I was like, it'd been like 18 months. I was like, hey, what am I doing here? I'm like, I can be a teacher and started applying in different places and, was getting some resistance and, or like it wasn't happening as, rapidly as I hoped. And, I don't know, being in Newfoundland, maybe like a lot of people go up north and you're hearing like teaching in the north, you know, in Nunavut. Yeah, yeah. So I started to like kind of look into like teaching in Nunavut and that kind of went pretty far and then kind of fizzled out. And I was just kind of frustrated with this process. And I was like putting in all these applications. I don't know if you're like doing these jobs, these applications, you're writing a new cover letter for every job. And it's like so much work. And I was like, you know what? I have more success when I just kind of call people and talk to them. And so I just cold called the school district in the Northwest Territories. It was the Beaufort Delta Educational District. And I got like the assistant superintendent is a small district. And I was like, on a Monday, I'm like, hey, you know, I'm a certified teacher. I'm looking for a job. And he's like, hey, there's a high school, there's a school that might need a teacher and I'll send your resume over. I get a call like 20 minutes later. And it's that principal being like, hey, I got your resume. Can you do an interview tomorrow? So I do the interview on Tuesday. They call me back.
It's like a Zoom or?
Yeah, Zoom interview. Yeah. And they call me like 20 minutes after that and say, we checked your references and you're hired. When can you come? And I was like, oh no, what have I done?
What have I done?
And living in Victoria at the time and yeah, I bought as much time as I could. I think I went up a month later, maybe several weeks, bought parkas and boots and all the stuff, and went up in February to the Arctic Circle and landed.
Yeah. How many students were in the school?
140. My class was eight students in my class, and I was teaching grade seven in an all indigenous school.
And you're teaching the whole, before they're split up into like math and English and everything, just grade seven.
Yeah. Like what you would know as like a classroom,
like elementary school,
Yeah. Grade seven, eight split, but teaching them every subject. And I trained as a music specialist. And so there's a pretty steep learning curve there.
And now you're teaching 13-year-olds algebra.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Algebra is actually like so cool. And that's been my experience in education. You know, it's like, it's this way to learn all these wonderful things you've always been interested in. And you find yourself like just cramming some science unit to teach.
Yeah. It's funny. You know, you hear that old adage that the best way to learn is to teach, right? You find that true as a teacher?
So true. I could spend the rest of the interview talking about it, but I mean, one example, when I was trained to be a music teacher, you have to learn every instrument in the orchestra, you know what I mean? Or like in the band or whatever. So, but you're learning it through this pedagogical lens, like through, you know, the lens of like, that you're going to have to teach it somebody. And it's such a nice way to learn something. So you have these like quick classes where you're like, you know, clarinet, and you just like find out how you have to teach that. And then next thing you know, you're actually like doing pretty well on all these instruments. And, I could speak about it so much, but, that experience was like, so I'm in this town. And so the town of Fort McPherson, I think it's like just shy of 1,000 people. I won't quote the population in case it's changed or not accurate, but this wonderful town, isolated. The next town's like 200 kilometers on like a frozen road, or you're isolated when you're in between rivers up there, like right off the Mackenzie River.
When the ice roads are not ice.
When the ice roads are not ice, and you're stuck for, you know, during breakup or whatever they call it, for a few months, you're on an island or a month. And it truly changed my life for sure. Spending just shy of 2 years there very recently.
Yeah, well, you've been back
since like June.
Just this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I've seen you've played 3 gigs now at Guild since you've been back.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's just amazing. Like, you know, I was playing a lot of music up there. Country Western is the.
It's the bread and butter up there.
It is, yeah. And there's a really unique, like, indigenous fiddling kind of style.
I love the fiddle. It's one of my all-time favorite instruments.
Yeah.
So it's such a beautiful instrument.
Yeah, I was aware of the fiddling culture up there before I went, just doing some research through, you know, musicology kind of perspective. And I took a fiddle up with me because I knew it was such a thing. So I took a fiddle.
Do you play?
I'm not bad now. I spent all my kids, like every kid plays fiddle. Like that's barely hyperbolic. It's like tons of fiddle and old time fiddle dances. I would mostly play bass in the old time fiddle band. But in the classes I'd have and I got to the school and there's all these fiddles. So it's always, class was so loud and just kids are always playing fiddle. And I was always playing with them, you know.
But it's one of those instruments that the learning curve is like you can not play guitar, and not to belittle guitar as an art form or as an instrument, but you can bang out, if you got 3 weeks, you can perfect a Bob Dylan tune. Totally. If you've got any hand-eye coordination and any rhythm at all, it's not hard. That doesn't exist. For an instrument like the fiddle, it's you sound like shit until you're really good. And to get to that point where you sound okay, you're already really good if you can sound okay.
I never achieved any level of mastery on that instrument, but
Did I just accidentally insult you?
No. I was just thinking about it.
It's a beautiful instrument.
Oh, it's the most beautiful, and I love it. And I think things I like about it, it's like, it's the most physical of the melodic instruments.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Like so many conductors are like violin players because like the bow, if you think about piano, you're seeing this, you know what I mean? Like so many instruments, but it's just like, this is physical. And like, I think the bow, like the friction based chordophone, is just so special, like using the bow and of course, like, you know, playing guitar and having frets. Yeah, the tuning part of it. Yeah, just I play that instrument and like just to improve my musicality. So like almost like being aware that I'm not trying to get good at fiddle just like kind of helps me get better at music and helps my pitch. And something about it being like in your face, it's like on your neck and you're hearing these tones and you're like having to think about pitch. Because on guitar, you're like, I really think there's something like you don't have to think about pitch and you don't have to actually even think about what note you're playing. But like, I learned brass instruments in my education degree. And you actually have to think like, what note am I playing right now? And you're like, you know, it's okay. Like, think about what harmonic you're on. You have to really listen. And guitar, you don't have to listen. And I think,
because if it's in tune, you know what note you're
and
playing.
And you know the shape. So you can kind of disassociate. Maybe not everyone does. Maybe that's my own issue with it. But, so I love those instruments for that. But playing bass in the old time fiddle bands, man, that's like my favorite. You know, and it allowed me to really make real connections really quick. I found myself in quite authentic situations that maybe most people wouldn't get in because, you know, music is, it kind of cuts through all the stuff and culturally. And so I start going to these, like, these concerts and like music pays so well up there. Like folks, like, it's almost like Europe or somewhere, these really respect musicians in these indigenous communities. And it's almost one of these musics that's more like functional, like, where it's like music's in like, I don't know, for example, like somewhere in Africa where like somebody is playing along and like for a ceremony or something on like whatever, like percussion instruments. It's like, it's not so much like you're not a performer as much as you're like there to play the thing so people can dance or so whatever. And it's all really prescribed. And I feel like the music, maybe this is true for like these old time fiddle, like square dancing events, but it was new to me because that music's kind of new to me. But you're just doing this thing that's really functional, so it like pays super well. So I was like, sure, whenever they ask me, can you come do this thing? I'm like, yeah, of course. And I started going with my guitar, and it was like people play guitar and they know all these tunes that I don't know. And I remember getting to one gig and a wonderful musician up there, I was trying to think of his name, I always mix him up with another person. He would bring a bass, and one time, kind of like, you know, it was a man of few words, and we kind of just like, I get to the gig and kind of like look at the bass, and I'm like, okay. So I played bass on one gig, and then it was just like every time I come, there'd just be a bass there, and then so you're like, I'm just playing bass with the old time fiddle band, and it's like, I don't know, you've been in a square dancing, it's like it's like 40 minutes on the same jam, you know, so people can do the thing. So I'd just be playing these 4 hour country bass gigs, like ding, 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 ding. Anywho, so that was a big part of my experience up there, and definitely what an amazing experience. I went up 2 years. My partner stayed in BC when I went, so I was up there and on my own. And when it's fully dark out, minus 50, it's pretty serious, you know?
Yeah, and it's, what were the longest nights up there? Like 20 hours?
No, I was there for 24 hours of light in June before I'd come back in the summers.
You were there for 24 hours a night and 24 hours dark?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the dark's better than the light.
Really?
Yeah, I don't mean that metaphorically, folks. But literally, the dark side.
It's easier to deal with 24 hours of dark than it is 24 hours of night.
Yeah, 24 hours late is not okay. It's really not cool.
Yeah.
And that comes along with in the Northwest Territories, it comes along with the mosquitoes. So the combination of the sun never going down and just being terrorized by insects is like pretty hard on one's mental health. And but it gets bad for a couple of weeks and then come back for the summer. But imagine the summers up there are beautiful. And especially like later in August and the fall. But The darkness, yeah. I mean, it's like, I'm the cold. I miss the cold, man. People are always asking, like, oh, how do you deal with cold? That's my favorite part of it. It's just, like, so dry. Yeah. And, like most all of spring, it's just, like, minus 25 and sunny. And just, like, never snows. And it's just sunny and, like, crisp and beautiful. Northern lights.
Yeah, and if you're dressed for it, you're fine.
Yeah, totally.
Minus 25. Dry minus 25 is a piece of cake. I did some work as a mineral surveyor when I was 20, I think. So I did a couple of jobs in like North Central Quebec and okay. Never that far up north, but I did some in Northern BC and I did, you know, some jobs where you were, it's minus 25 to minus 40, but sunny, you're cruising around on your snowmobile, you know, the worst thing you have to remember to do is keep your nose sunscreened because you don't think you're going to need sunscreen because it's winter.
Oh, and
it's like the first season I went up there and did it. I probably gonna get skin cancer on my nose because I
just burnt.
Yeah,
the sun off the snow too. Like
yeah,
that was a wonderful experience. There's an event there that I really want to do. I'm gonna say it on air so it perhaps will it into existence. But there's a music festival up there called Midway Lake Music Festival. So the town I was in, Tetlege, Fort McPherson, the Gwich'in people have this this music festival, and started this town, this Midway Lake, which was just some people that had cabins there. And 40 years ago they started it, and it's gone every year. And it's an indigenous, like fully indigenous run country music festival. There's now like, it's like the town of Midway. There's people live there all year round, and it's this wonderful festival that people from all over the north go to. And the whole time is there, folks. Like, you gotta come to Midway. You gotta do Midway, being like involved in the music as I was. And it's my dream for the Star Captains to go play Midway Lake Music Festival. So
yeah.
I hope that happens someday.
Yeah. Make it happen.
Yeah, right on. I'm
going to crack one of these. That's a good idea. I have to make it a spectacle of it, because if I don't, it's just like, what's that weird crack on the microphone, you know? Yeah. Cheers.
Hey, cheers.
What is I'll take a sip first, quiet down then. You talk about playing, you know, bass. Like guitar is where you started, right?
Yeah.
So you talk about playing bass in like a fiddle band when you're up north, and that being something, you know, very, that whole country western being something very new to you. What would you say were your sort of roots in your musical education and growing up, not just in education, but in what you gravitated towards as a you know, young person being introduced to music, but also as a young artist creating music?
Yeah, that's really easy. My parents were big music fans. They loved the performing arts, but they weren't musicians themselves. So they took me to the most concerts, like perhaps for some of my peers.
First concert?
Oh, I can't even say. I don't know. It's probably like in the womb at like, you know, like a concert, like, and like back in the days, like they didn't have the headphones for kids and stuff. It would be like rock concerts. And it's like, it's actually at a concert last night, and I went to see Portugal the Man. Last night.
Cool.
And I saw a kid there sleeping, and that was me at the concerts, because I'd go with my parents and be like, oh, I don't want to be here. And it'd be like, in hindsight, it'd be like these amazing concerts, like the Neville Brothers. And I was like, I'm going to sleep. I'm like 8 years old or something. But I don't remember the first one. It was just such a huge part of our life. So like, yeah, I think where some of my peers, like maybe their parents were musicians, or my parents didn't play, and there was music in my family a bit, but they just love the performing arts. So like I saw the Rolling Stones like 5 times as like a little kid, and all the rock. They took us to like shows that we were interested in. So they took us to see, like, I remember we saw Blind Melon, Pearl Jam, and Neil Young. I remember being really young, and my parents were like, this is sweet.
How old were you for Blind Melon? You're not much older than me.
I'm 41.
You must have been 12.
Yeah.
You saw him right before he died.
Yeah, it was like that time. Yeah. I actually have a bunch of concert tickets from 1994. I saw Pink Floyd on my birthday, 12th birthday in 1994. Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion tour, my parents took us to.
I went to the Use Your Illusion tour.
Oh, yeah, cool. For sure. And yeah.
They just played here.
Right.
I was like, I had no idea that they were all still alive and doing that. But
so many concerts lately. And everyone's like, I just saw the Guns N' Roses last night. I'm like, what? So so many concerts and some really authentic experiences. Like we went one time to see the Rolling Stones play in Las Vegas, and it's my dad's favorite band. And we were staying at this hotel in like the old part of Vegas, and Chuck Berry was playing that night. And so they took us to see Chuck Berry.
Is this the pre-hotel scandal, Chuck Berry?
Yeah, or no, maybe post.
Maybe post.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, well, maybe this is part of the story. Like he's kind of a bad dude, but... Or like extremely bad dude, I don't know. but we saw this concert, and at the time we were just young, impressionable kids. And I mean, I was so young, like, but in hindsight, realizing that I knew that the Rolling Stones were influenced by Chuck Berry, like this, like understanding, like my parents, because like,
having that musical connection.
At like 10 years old, like understanding that British, you know, rock was influenced by American blues, and being able to like kind of. Because my parents, that was like my parents, like I, even in hindsight, like people talk about like kids books and all these kids songs. I'm like, I don't know any of them because my parents were just like, listen to Led Zeppelin. You know what I mean? Like, so they took us to see, and we saw Chuck Berry, and we like got up on stage, and like he like invited us on stage, and we like whatever at the time. And the next day we were in the hotel lobby, and we see Chuck Berry sitting there, and he's just sitting by himself, and he's like a mean person. And I've heard people like say stories that he like refused to give them autographs and stuff. Like I've heard famous people say this. And we went up to him, and we're like, these like little kids. We're like, Mr. Chuck Berry, like, can we have your autograph? And he's like, no, don't do autographs. He's like, but I got to wait for my car so you can come outside with me and wait for my car. So he just stood there and smoked a cigarette and didn't even look at us. And then he's like, all right, you're good kids. I'll write an autograph. And he wrote like Happy School Days, like one of his songs on like the hotel kind of notepad. But so just thinking back on those experiences as like a 10 and 12 year old, and like no surprise, I'm like, I want a guitar. And my cousin, his name's Mark Olickson. He's a popular Western Canadian musician, and shout out, perhaps like most influential on getting me to play, because he was managing the Long McQuaid Music Store at this time, as my parents just took me there. And he was like, here, like, they wanted to get me an instrument and got me the Stratocaster, and the one I still use and played at Kilton Co. the other day. Like,
oh, really?
He kind of picked that out. This like red.
I mean, American, it's a Stratocaster.
Yeah, red American Stratocaster. Like, thanks, Mark. And
your cousin picked it out?
Yeah, yeah. My parents was like, oh, I need like a good instrument. And so he has influence there. But you know, getting that guitar, and it's the '90s, and like, you know, grunge music was
everything.
Yeah. And like that's not far away. Yeah. And you know, thinking about that in context, like there was definitely like we were in these bands and we were hearing that stuff. And it's so cool that like now it's like this, it's like 30 years later and the kids are into it, you know?
Oh, I know. I see kids in, but I mean they never stopped wearing Nirvana shirts.
That never stopped.
No. And I don't think they're culturally, I think they have as much like impact into the zeitgeist of youth as like the Beatles or the Stones. I don't think that they are as important musically, but like that the iconography of that font of Nirvana is just is pervasive in the mental landscape as the giants of the 60s.
Totally.
But it's weird when you see, like, I saw someone wearing an Alice in Chains t-shirt the other day. And I was like, and they were like 20. I'm like, could you name one song?
I overheard some 10th graders the other day.
It's like watching people with Che Guevara t-shirts. You're like, I don't know if this works.
Totally, totally. I overheard in my classroom the other day a 10th grader say, like, yeah, you know, Elaine Staley's a great singer. I really like, love Alice in Chains. I was like, am I hearing this right now? Like, totally like love in the 90s. So having that all come back is so interesting. And I think there's this like this wonderful thing that I guess every generation's got to experience of when the thing from your childhood comes back into style. And you're like, I know everything about this.
And you're still not cool.
And it's still not cool, but I'm like wearing plaid more now. And like I bought a denim jacket. And I'm like, I was there.
I was there.
I was at Woodstock.
Yeah. 94.
So to answer your question, really, I think that's the thing, that how I got into music was that, and I've reflected on this so much, I think part of it is just, is like, I don't want to say appeasing, but also just like appreciating like when you're playing this music. So when I was a little kid, it'd be like a kid now playing Nirvana riff, we'd be like, that's so cool, I love that. And then they're like, cool, yeah. I'm getting this positive reinforcement from this like adult person and I respect or whatever. And then you get more into it and go, I'm gonna learn all the 90s songs. So that was like when we're learning these like Zeppelin riffs and stuff, and your parents are like, that's the best. I remember when I saw Led Zeppelin. And so you just like, my whole early kind of, you know, forays into music were based in classic rock, and all those like rock guitar heroes were just right there. And we had some kind of like anti-heroes of our time and stuff, but definitely was connected with the, like, you know, the prodigious 60s and 70s stuff, and
yeah,
was like learning all those riffs and like loved it the most. Like I had every Led Zeppelin record in like seventh grade and could like recite the track order. And
yeah.
Like could, you know, the Stairway solo was like the goal to know that, you know what I mean?
I mean, I could probably like rig-a-goo-goo, you know, mouth most of it, but I never learned to play it.
It's still, it's a kind of an inside Star Captain's joke that we're like Stairway.
Stairway.
It's always good. A quick tangent. Have you heard us play Smells Like Teen Spirit?
Oh yeah.
At Guilt and Go?
Yeah.
It's so much fun. And it's just like.
You guys played it at your last gig.
We played it. Yeah. At the last gig. And I feel
I think you closed the night with it, or you were very close to closing the night with it.
So awesome to hear Ray singing that one.
Yeah.
So that's how it started, and then just playing, and then really, I think joining that music program at Semiahmoo in 10th grade. So I kind of joined late. Supposed to start like concert band on bass maybe, which is like what Gavin did. Same high school. Gavin and I went to the same high school, a few years apart. But he started bass in 8th grade. He started fiddle when he was a little kid, Gavin.
Oh, really?
And then, as the story goes, his parents were like, he's like, I want to play guitar. And his parents like, when you turn whatever age, if you keep playing the fiddle until then, you can get a guitar. So he played fiddle until his like 10th birthday. And it was like, I'm ready now. Like, give me the guitar. But then the way it works at this high school, or I guess a lot of high school music programs, there's no guitar in concert band. So you play bass if you're interested. And then maybe
I played bass in band in high school. Yeah,
totally. And then maybe if your school has a jazz program, that's in our case was part of the timetable. But a lot of times it's like before school or after school or whatever. But we went to Semiahmoo and it was like part of the whole curriculum there or in the timetable. And then, but I skipped all that. And there was like in my Malcolm Gladwell moment, if you look at, you know, from this Gladwellian approach, there was no guitar player in 10th grade at the high school in this wonderful music program. And it was like, well, Jim, you play guitar? And like Tim, it was like Tim Prozick was like, you play, you should, why don't you, you come? And, you know, people are like nervous about stuff. And I thought maybe there'd be an audition. It was like, Dave Prosnick's such a wonderful person that he didn't believe in auditioning anyone. So he let me be a part of it. I remember the band started and I wasn't playing, and he stops the band. And he's like, why aren't you playing, Jim? And I was like, what's this chord? And it was like C major 7, like pretty easy chord. And he's like, oh no. So, I had to learn pretty quick, but that year we went to this music festival, this band competition kind of festival in the States, in Idaho, and our 10th grade band won our division for the whole festival.
Cool.
And that might have been the moment where I was like, I'm hooked. I want to do this. And I remember being in the back, because it was like in this big stadium and few thousand people there, and there's people with headphones and like, hey, you know, stand here, and you kind of walk up the grate, and it's like, and yeah, I just remember that being so cool. And after that, I took it really seriously, got lessons, and took lessons in Vancouver from a person named Dave Martone. Shout out. Have you ever heard Dave Martone?
It sounds familiar, but maybe just from here.
Amazing player in kind of like a maybe like progressive rock. I don't know if that genre is like limiting, because he's like so much more than that as a player. It's like really skilled in like kind of flamenco styles and all these other things, but he's kind of our like Canadian Joe Satriani. Yeah.
I wish we had an audio search option to just see if someone else has mentioned the same name in any of these podcasts, because I would be surprised if someone has, because it does sound familiar.
Yeah. Yeah. Right on. So I was taking lessons from that person, and that's when I really kind of ramped it up. So yeah, I mean, like, yeah, rock music and the guitar, and I still feel like, that's something I know a lot about, that I spent a lot of time working on. You know, of all the things, I've kind of been really interested in a lot of different things, but a huge chunk of my life, you know, studying rock guitar, you know. Speaking of, you know, we mentioned earlier Scott Rupeek, you know, there's a person like me and him start talking about Led Zeppelin. So you give that guy a guitar and start talking about Led Zeppelin, it's like so much fun. Like,
he was over at my house earlier this summer, and it was actually really funny because they were all I think they were coming in. He came in with my partner Freya. They were out doing something. I don't remember what, but they were like in fun mode, and I was very much in like. No, I think I was either working or I was just grumpy or hungover, or I don't remember what it was. But I was very much not in fun mode, and for whatever reason, couldn't join fun mode. And they came in, and Scott just like sits on the couch, rolls up a joint, and I just put. I had Spotify going on. Shuffle, and it was shortly after, maybe not shortly after, it was a while after, but Tool came on Shuffle, and it was something from their first album. And he immediately starts like, and him and I immediately got into like a 15-minute conversation about Tool. And I had never spoken about Tool with Scott before, but he's just one of those guys who you get him on a tangent about one thing and he can just fucking go, and it's really
cool.
Fun. Yeah. Hearing him talk about guitar players.
I used to love Tool, man. Air drumming to Tool.
That's the best air drumming ever.
I got to meet Danny Carey once.
Really?
And probably a testament to how much Tim Prosnick has been a part of my life. He introduced me to my partner and got me into this music program. And him and I met Danny Carey. Three biggest moments of my life. No, I'm just kidding. But two of those are. Tim used to play. Do you remember the wonderful at Bar None in Yale Town? It used to be. Oh my goodness, how am I not remembering the name of this band? Amazing cover band that used to play at Bar None. Oh, that's bad. It'll come to me in a minute when I tell the story. Tim used to play with them and all the top players in town, all the folks. And it was like Monday and Tuesday night, so it was kind of like an industry thing. And we were there one night, and Tool was playing at the stadium. And I was kind of aware of that. And then at some point at the end of the night, there's this like 6'5" person with like long straight hair staying at the bar. I'm like, Tim, man, that's Danny Carey. He's like, no, it's not. And I'm like, dude, it's totally Danny Carey. So we go up and we're like, you're Danny Carey. He's like, hey, guys. And he was like the nicest person. And he's like, hey, the bar's closed. And you guys think you can get me a drink? Like, because we were like, we're in the band. And I'm like, sure. So like, Tim got him a drink. And then we proceeded to stand there and talk to Danny Carey for like 15 minutes. And he only wanted to talk about mountain biking on the North Shore. And he was like super bashful. He just kept like putting his hair behind his ears. He's like, oh, man. Kind of like, I was just like, it was like such a cool conversation.
I listened to an interview with I don't even remember who it was, which member of the band it was, but they were talking about how they wrote their last album because they're all in different cities. And they will like basically just send each other compositions, and they just keep adding to each other's compositions and then just sending them in the last. Keen is the last person that gets anything. And puts the vocals onto it.
And like all of it without even consulting them, and then they just get it back.
It's a really, I'm totally butchering it because it was a long time ago that I heard this interview. But it was neat to hear them talk about their process for creating their later albums because they've all, and I think one of the things that I actually really like about that band is they've evolved. They haven't like, they haven't tried to continue to stick the square peg in the round hole. You know, their first album came out in 93.
Totally.
And you listen to that album and you listen to the newest one that came out four years ago, I think. And they've actually, like, there's quite an evolution, and they're very, very different, but they've managed to create something unique in all of them.
Such a wonderful group.
My nerddom about Tool.
Oh yeah. No, that's what it's about. Nerding out about Tool. You know, and I'd say the way that we have been composing over this last period of time with Star Captains is somewhat analogous to that process.
Right. You guys have been spread out a bit too.
We've been spread out. And when I was in Newfoundland, I was composing a lot, sending it back. I mean, traditionally, for the Lightwork record, we were all in the same room and we basically just wrote it and recorded it at just in one process.
It's a great record, by the way. You should shout out that record because it's available on Spotify and Apple Music and all the places, SoundCloud, everywhere you can find your music, it's available.
Yeah, thanks for that. No, it's definitely worth shouting out. I think that's probably like the greatest achievement in my life is that record, you know? I mean, it's so beautiful and...
You should do some vinyl prints for me.
I've been thinking that. So now that you said that, that's might have been the little push I needed. That record, like... So we built the Space Studios and we're like, hey, we're going to record. And then we recorded a few songs. And then we like kind of stopped doing that. And we just kind of got busy running the studio. And our Dan Klenner, that was the full-time engineer at that time. And he just started working full-time for all these great artists around. And then his skills just got like super, you know, he's at the height of his skills. And we're like, hey, we got like a month or something, a few weeks. And we went in there and we just like, we had maybe some demos, maybe some things that we had been playing live, but like we just like wrote a bunch of stuff, and actually it kind of got to the point, I think, if I recall correctly, that as well as ones where you have a bunch of tunes and then all these new ones that came at that time because we were like kind of super inspired and the space was just dialed in and Dan was at the top of his skills, we kind of just like wrote a whole new album and kind of record it as we were writing, because Dan Klenner's like so fast. Shout out Dan Klenner. He's like just like producing so fast, and he's like one of the people that like he can like sequence like how he would play, you know. That's one thing I love about Dan's productions, like he can be like building something in the box, like just penciling in drum parts and stuff, and right. It's like what he would play in real life. It's like he's so musical, and I've never seen someone be so musical inside of a computer. But yeah, that record came together and like so many beautiful moments, and it happened really quick. And those songs, like, yeah, the productions, like, I don't know. The next recording, I don't think we'll go that direction, because it's just like, it's so like ornate.
So there is a next recording.
Oh. Maybe I'll have to pour another shot for this one. Yeah, so I think like.
Ooh. See when? Full shot, half shot, quarter shot.
When? So when I was up north,
I gotta mind this table.
It's very, very resonant with this.
I can't complain about the table. I complained about the last chairs so much. Yeah. Table's great. We love the table.
Wonderful table and an excellent setup here. I feel very comfortable.
It's me. It's an operator malfunction.
It's like, when I was up north, at this point, I was a bit kind of like disenfranchised with the guitar as an instrument. I was kind of like interested in some other things, kind of more interested in like, you know, digital music making processes and when I went up north, it kind of was like, you know, I was playing these country Western things and I was like playing acoustic guitar, and I just like, there's always guitars at school, and I started playing acoustic guitar, and I was like, actually, you know, and it was the Lightwork record where it was like when I don't know if this happens for other groups, but when a record's so produced and when you compose it, you record it while you're composing it. It's like there's some of those songs that we've never played live and we can't play because like we've never played them. So, right. You know, and probably like later Beatles records where it wasn't like we didn't play them on the road for a year and then put them down. It was like we just wrote them and then just like left them there. We love listening to them or whatever, but I couldn't even tell you what key some of them are in. You know what I mean? Like, I probably didn't even play on 25% of it. And And I was up north, and it was kind of getting to me where if someone was like, hey, like, play a Star Captain song, like, I wouldn't know how to play it. So actually, it's funny. Mike Agranovich had filled in, and he wrote these beautiful charts. Well, they weren't beautiful, actually. They were, he just like wrote them in like a word process.
Yeah, they weren't beautiful.
Terrible. No, they wrote them in a word process, so they're very simple, and they're really like kind of like concise. And almost like, you know, just kind of put them in a word processor. And they're super accurate because Mike's like just this kind of musical genius guy. He's got such great like pitch and like, so they were like really accurate. And so I got to see, I'm like, oh, this song looks pretty interesting, you know? And I started learning all, and I had all this time. I'm in the Arctic and just like at night I'm chilling. There's no one else there and friends who work or whatever. But I just started learning all the Star Captain songs on acoustic guitar. Like simplifying the arrangements. Like
relearning the, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, learning yeah. for the first time, like with a capo and playing like G's and C's and stuff, you know what I mean? Like simplifying them to be able to do them that way and perhaps yeah. like romantically imagining a scenario where we come back and I can, me and Ray can do that or something, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah, yeah.
And that process and playing with the kiddos, like I just kind of like started to love guitar again, started to love the acoustic guitar again. And I kind of, there's like no acoustic guitar rule for like a decade. Because no one could make me play acoustic guitar. I was exploring like...
We made you play acoustic guitar and we didn't even have to try it. We just left one sitting out. And when you walked in today, you picked it up and played it.
My cold heart has been melted by the wonderful people of the Northwest Territories. I have that effect on folks. Shout out to the Gwich'in people. And I started playing these tunes and during that process, I started like kind of composing a ton and I had like my stuff up there and microphones and I was composing a lot. And I'd say it's fair to say like most Star Captain's compositions start from Max and Gavin. Max probably mostly. And then Gavin's kind of like, can musically solve a Rubik's Cube in like 2 minutes, you know what I mean? Like, so we'd have some chords and some ideas and Gavin would be like, oh, here's how it should be and should have this thing and that should actually be this chord. And we're like, thanks, Gavin. But a few of the songs, they're like the Lennon McCartney and maybe I'm like the George Harrison, you know, or like.
Oh, well, that's, you know, like George Harrison was always the coolest one.
It's the coolest one.
Yeah. Now I'm totally going to get the set. I'm going to get Gavin and Ray up here and they're all going to fight about who's the coolest one.
Totally. I love it. And maybe fact, only.
I'm going to Ray's here later this month. So I'm going to be like, Jim said he was cooler than you. I'm just saying.
Jim's the Star Captain, like the Star Captain. No.
He said you were Ringo.
Yeah. Ringo was the most popular Beatle. He got the most fan mail. Like,
did he?
Oh yeah. Everyone loved Ringo the most. And I'd say I'm only the George of the band for the amount of my compositions that, and they weren't excluded, like not like in a negative way.
Well, I'm on guitar, John the Reeps. That was George Harrison, wasn't it?
Totally.
And Eric Clapton, oddly enough.
Oddly enough. So, if I were to really, you know, Gavin probably really is the George Harrison. Cause if we want to talk about it, like George Harrison is kind of the most skilled musician in the Beatles, you know what I mean? Like whatever. Anyways, I digress. So I wrote a bunch of tunes up there and like, Narae and I were kind of like sending them back and forth and connecting on that. And so there's a number of compositions that have come from that kind of inspiration and that output. We played some of them at Guilt & Company, actually.
At the most recent show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dealing with pretty serious themes, you know, like, you know, life has happened and we've written a really beautiful composition kind of in through an experience of like bereavement. Narae lost her mom a year ago.
Yeah. I remember when that happened.
The reason I came back from the North was I lost my mother in June, in May.
Cheers to moms. I lost mine in 2017.
Cheers. Cheers. And, you know, I don't mean to get that real in an interview, but I think that's kind of like, I guess the point of what I was going to say, where it's like this, the music that we're making now deals with these themes. And I don't think there's a rehearsal or a performance where tears, you know, aren't shed. Like
right.
when we're having rehearsals lately, like we keep noticing this, like it just ends up like just people, you know, people, like just tapping into these emotions and you know, we're getting on in life, and you know, it's like as you get older, life happens, and these themes are coming into our music. So you know, there's, I mean, I'm not saying this is gonna be a drab recording, but definitely some serious depths in the emotion.
When you write, do you find yourself writing from a do you write thematically? Do you write from a composition base? Do you write with lyrics in mind? Do you put lyrics in afterwards? Are you a lyric guy or not a lyric guy? What's your what's your approach, if you have one? Is it just all a Mad Hatter feeling?
You know, I feel so fortunate that I get to play music with my best friends, the Star Captains. And since I've had that safety net and that group there this whole time, everything I compose goes through that channel first.
Right.
Any idea I have, I just send it directly to Nere. And if like 4 years later she's not done anything with it, maybe I'll like share it with someone else and say, hey, do you want to like rap on this or something? If it's a dope beat. But just last week I was teaching the kiddos and dealing with some emotional themes in one of our classes, a kind of like healthy living kind of subject. And the music that was in the this beautiful TED Talk, kind of like, I'm teaching guitar, I'm teaching English. So, you know,
this is the like in the high school, right?
You're teaching, currently right? Teaching in high school. And yeah. I teach English 8, English 9, music, like guitar, composition, and career life education 10. Oddly enough, it was the career life education 10 class where I was like all up in my feelings. I mean, this funny thing, you're teaching junior high kids and you're like, this is super important. You gotta like think about this. And yeah. Kids sometimes are indifferent, but you're like, you know, you're like reading this poetry and getting super, like, so I'm like in my feeling. And it's like 9 a.m. on a Tuesday and you're like, give me a minute, kids. So I just went into my my room and I voice noted a track and sent it to her. I mean, I was going to play it, but I don't have my phone. But just played it quick, sent it to her with some text and, you know, maybe some text that might inspire some direction. But usually it's actually like, I'm really good at starting things. Like, if you ever, like, I did one of those, like, four.
Like here's a riff, go.
I did four producers on one sample thing, and it was like, I was so good at it. Cause it's like, if it's just like an idea and a key and you get a beat, and it's like, cool, there's all the elements to start a thing. Like, I can do that just like over and over again really fast. Again, solving, like, putting that all together, like, composing, having a theme, a message, which Nere is something that she's super gifted at. And there's actually like this whole kind of like, there's a message in everything she does. And it's like this design language that's embedded within her whole, you know, everything she does. And, so maybe because that's so there, and then, you know, Gavin's so good at putting all these pieces together. And what we've arrived to lately is I start something and almost we kind of like put it through this filter that is Max and Gavin. So I'll have this beat.
Yeah.
And it'll be like some drums and maybe guitar things, some keyboards. And then it'll be like, hey, Max and Gavin, what do you think? And then in like 2 minutes, you know, they're just like, they've come up with all these new chords and these ideas. And it's gone, you know, so far from where it started. And I was like, that's amazing. And then in that process, and Ray's kind of finding ideas for it. But I don't often compose lyrics. There was one experience where I was up north and I was going through some challenges. Like just I'd just been there for a few months and I we're right on this massive river that's like a kilometer across. And one day I'm like, I'm gonna go walk out in the middle of the river. It's like minus 40 and like frozen bodies of water were still a great novelty to me. And I walk out there and with like no snowshoes, I should have snowshoes. I'm just like trudging along. And then it just gets to this point where I'm like, And I just composed one of my beats I'm talking about. And it was just like this like kind of driving kind of thing with acoustic guitar. And I hadn't like, just was like, I'm loving acoustic guitar again. I made this thing. I'm loving it. I'm just like walking and it's beautiful. I'm like, I'm going to walk across this whole river. And I walk and like, and I'm just like, to the point where I'm just like, get to the other side of this river. And I'm like, what have I done? I look back. It's like so far. And I'm seeing all these wolf tracks. And I'm like, am I in like a bad situation right now? Like I'm in the woods. And, and it was just so emotional that I trudged back and I sent that composition with like stream of thought, kind of free write about like kind of, you know, some kind of many rivers to cross kind of like take on that song, you know, like, you know, it's a, or like The Climb by Miley Cyrus, if you will, you know. It's, you know, how fast you get there. It's, you know, it's about the journey. Shout out to Miley Cyrus. Hannah Montana probably at that point.
It's probably Hannah Montana at that point.
Somehow.
I mean, it's been Miley Cyrus for a while.
And you know, it's like that's kind of my thing too, right? Like my interest and my, like Jimmy Cliff and Hannah Montana are going to come up in the same breath, you know, in the way I think about music, like. Teaching the kiddos has really removed all, I hope, like all the prejudice, you know, and I've gone through points where I'm still like, oh, this or that. But and when I'm at my best, I try to have a little bias towards any genre or type of music.
Yeah. Well, I think that like what's one of the things that makes music so beautiful is it transcends bias.
Yeah.
It is purest form. It's so much better than all of that bullshit. Facts. It's like, it doesn't none of that means anything. Like what kind of music do you like is like, I don't know. How do you like your eggs cooked? You're still eating fucking eggs.
100, 100. I think the culinary arts are like maybe the only other space that, you know, is like music that way that brings people together and breaks down barriers.
Yeah. Food and music, the true universal languages.
Ugh, two of my favorites.
So when are you playing next? Where are you playing next? Where can your and where can your students come see you play? Because they can't come see you play at the places that I provide for people to play.
No. My students heard me perform today. Actually, we had a guest, an ex student came by the school. He's studying to be a teacher and came by, and we did a performance for the kids in class today, which was really nice. No, free of cover charge. The next performance, December 9th, Crescent Beach Legion, Club 240, White Rock, South Surrey. Our nonprofit arts society is putting on a concert, and it's a very 90s Christmas. So, you know, speaking of our affinity for the 90s and how it's coming back into style, we've started a 90s rock.
We're both wearing plaid, by the way.
Like 90s. We started this.
I never stopped dressing like it was the 90s.
Always. We started. Well, actually, we had this like kind of like dad rock band. Like started a little bit prematurely. We're like, we want to be in a dad rock blues band, and we started this band like the Velvet Bulldozer. We played at Guilt and Company a number of times.
Oh yeah.
But it's kind of like, you know, kind of all over the place. And I came back from the north and. It's this idea that like the 90s are in, we're from the 90s, let's make this a 90s tribute band. So we have this 90s band, and it's called Jim's Boutique, a reference to Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique.
Yeah.
And we play authentic rock and ironic pop from the 90s.
Authentic pop and ironic pop from the 90s. Authentic rock and ironic pop.
That's it. And actually not even ironic because I just love it. We play Cher, Believe. Play I was actually just I was like blaring the playlist.
Madonna. You gotta do Madonna.
Oh man, yeah, actually. Well, it had to be like Ray of Light Madonna, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The most fun part has been doing deep dive on the 90s, and it's like it's so cool. I was just listening to the playlist, getting preparing for this gig, writing down here today. And I was blaring Waiting for Tonight by Jennifer Lopez. Classics.
She was Jennifer Lopez at the time. This is pre-J-Lo.
Perhaps it's pre-J-Lo.
Yeah.
So So yeah, that's it. All these 90s tunes. So that's happening December 9th and so, sorry. That's it. Nothing else on the books. I think we're doing like a little Christmas thing for Max Sapersky here, a little event, maybe around Christmas, but not a lot of stuff on the books, you know?
You're doing a Christmas gig for Max Sapersky?
Yeah, you know Max, like impresario, booking all the...
Yeah, he's a huge Christmas guy too.
Right, I see what you're doing. Oh, I almost want to tell the story of the worst gig of my life when we played the one time.
Yeah, no, let's close on you telling the story of the worst gig of your life. Okay, that's a good send off.
So we went to do a Christmas gig early in our professional entertainment career, and Christmas gig at this place in North Van, and I think we had a gig the night before, and it was in the morning. We weren't as bright as we could be, and in our infinite wisdom, we're like, we'll just buy this Easy Christmas Songs book and we'll just read these Christmas songs. But it was like, right. Easy Christmas Songs in the key of C major. So it was like all in one key. And we roll up there and we have Max, who's Jewish and so didn't grow up with Christmas songs. Nimish Parekh on bass and grew up in a household listening mostly Indian music. Myself, who like is not very good at reading music, and we're here like totally ill-equipped to play this one of our first Christmas gigs, and we're just playing these songs, and Nimish was the best at reading out of all of us, and so it gets to this point where Nimish is playing all the melodies on bass and me and Max are playing chords. And I remember when we played like Feliz Navidad, it's just like bam, 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 up on the bass, and this really sweet lady was like, you know what guys, like this isn't really sounding great. Like maybe you could like stop, you know, and then just maybe play something else. So then we're just playing funk songs in the store window of this retail shop. And I think maybe that was one of those wake up calls where we were like, hey, we better get better at this.
Better acquire some technical skills.
Come a long way since then. That was a long time ago. So, yeah. So that being said, I think we'll be more successful at this Christmas gig, but Max Sapersky has all his wonderful gigs he books and supporting all the local musicians. Yeah. Like he's
giant for that.
Yeah, yeah, done so well at it. And so that's it. No, I don't know whether, you know what, I just, we're already thinking like, when can we play at Guild & Company again? So
it's right away. Yeah.
Immediately.
I mean, I'm not in charge of that. But
Yes. But we know.
Paul.
Talking to you, Paul.
Paul.
If you make it to the end of this interview, yeah, shout me out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm going to cheers you with the final send-off of our good mezcal here.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for having me. It's such a treat to talk about music and our wonderful community and reminisce about wonderful times at Guild & Company, one of the finest music venues in all the land. So thanks to everything you folks do.
Well, we'll keep them coming.
Won't stop. Cheers.
Cheers.